listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Hello, Kitty. When Lena Dunham moved to London, it was her growing posse of independent cats that gave her a reality check. Illustrations of Cats by Cecilia Karlstedt. We're all human. We all make mistakes. That's the go-to defense of every influencer slinging an apology. She was caught posting negatively about her best friend from a burner account. We're all human. She cheated on her husband with a local mall cop. It could happen to any of us. Forgot to pay the interns who helped make her beaded choker brand a wild success. She's listening and learning. We're only as sick as our secrets, and we're all human. I watched a lot of these videos in my first full year living in London after moving for the always dubious reason known as love. I found myself nearly 35, noticing the hours that back home had been full of the noisy disharmony of family and friends were now ticked by the noise of watching other people argue with their friends. On The Real Housewives of Salt Lake City, on Dubai Bling, and on TikTok, of course, until I started to feel dense with toxic sludge where my blood should be. I had colleagues and acquaintances, but friends, a group of people that define films like Four Weddings and a Funeral, or any movie where Hugh Grant is inexplicably platonic besties with a woman who has a grown-out pixie cut, I did not have. But like any good cat lady, I realized we may all be human, but who says our friends have to be? Just like there's always a backstabbing, troublemaking entity in any reality TV girl gang, a cat brings the side eye, the discontent, the flair for the dramatic. My husband Luis and I were already living with two dogs, Ingrid, California girl, and Cornichon, Welsh. I figured I could build a friend group as dynamic in its range as any of the ones I was following, replete with the hot girl, the slattern, the upwardly mobile homosexual, the token straight guy, and the business bitch. Little did I know that just as British people do not behave like us Americans, neither do British cats. We found our first cat, where you find any it girl early in her career, on a local animal rescue page, advertised as a Maine Coon kitten in desperate need of a welcoming home. My husband was skeptical when I announced that she was located in Croydon, made famous as the birthplace of both Kate Moss and the Croydon facelift, a ponytail so tight it results in a receding hairline. But it was my birthday, and he could not resist the pathetic sight of a girl checking her phone again and again to see if anyone she knows might be available for dinner later. And so he gassed up the car and took me far enough that if we'd started in New York City, we'd have made it to Princeton, New Jersey in the same stretch. In a living room that smelled like menthols and competing colognes, a woman with a snatched forehead and heavy day drinking energy presented a group of kittens in a box that were clearly unrelated to each other. Luis blinked back at a white and mink kitten with ice blue crossed eyes and said, "That's not a Maine Coon. Actually, there are 33 kinds," the seller hissed. She had conveniently forgotten to list the adoption fee of £380. I shot him a look that said, "Get your ass to the cash point if you want this relationship to work." He named her Elegance, but barely looked at her for 3 days as she slept curled on the desk behind my computer. I, meanwhile, did not leave the house, so loud was her purr. On day 4, he asked, "When will we start letting her out?" "Excuse you? How about never? Is never good with you?" Growing up with hairless cats in New York City, we lived in terror of an escape. Even in the dead of August, windows remained shut, checked, and rechecked. These were flight risk we were dealing with, not pets. And the local horror story that haunted us was about a neighbor's cat who had fallen from a 10th floor window, stood up unscathed, and then walked beneath a cab. But in London, cats are considered only partially under human possession. Luisa's family cat, Chilichanga, had turned out to have two homes. When the family's distant neighbors realized she was leading a double life, and the second one stopped feeding her, for her own health, everyone said, but really, jealousy is a bitch, she moved into the cab of a local forklift. This is when Luis learned an important lesson. We are merely borrowing our cats. We are tasked with caring for them, just as we might a loaned rare book or a pair of vintage heels. With awe, respect, meticulous sensitivity, but no covetousness. Elegance would not go outside on my watch. When I left for a week, I made Luis assure me daily that the door to the garden was closed. But our local parliament member, Jeremy Corbyn, had encouraged his late cat, El Gato, himself a local legend, described by Corbyn to a newspaper as having socialist tendencies, to step out onto the front walk. Yes, I thought, but socialists love to share. When I returned from the airport, I looked out the bathroom window to find Elegance walking a fence 6 gardens down, looking confident and powerful. She even had a friend, a one-eyed tiger-striped gent named Casper, whose human guardian seemed almost smug when she said, "I hope he hasn't been too much trouble. He's a bit of a thug." When we were packing to move homes, Elegance and Casper disappeared for half a day and were finally located in the line at a coffee spot off Abbey Road, having one last date. Next, we welcomed Rhett, an obese 10-year-old orange tabby that Luis's parents needed to rehome when they moved out of the country. He had primarily been eating steak and was so big that we took him to his first vet appointment in a wicker laundry basket. He immediately took a dislike to me, perhaps because of internalized fat phobia. As Elegance spent more time slutting it up with whatever tuxedo-wearing gents she could find, and Rhett glared at me like we were stuck into detention together, I missed the innocence of kittenhood. Cats are like daughters, perfectly devoted companions until puberty, then heartbreakers, every single one, and became stuck on the idea of adopting a British Shorthair, the national cat of the British Isles, with their stubby legs and dense velvety fur and round cartoonish eyes. I told Luis that the difference between 2 and 3 cats could barely be felt. Then Truman arrived with near-constant diarrhea. Meanwhile, a friend's cat fell asleep on a moving truck and wound up appearing 3 months later on the Isle of Sheppey. The more cats we got, the more panic I experienced at the end of each day, shaking the treats at the garden door and hoping for a full head count by dinner time, like I was a school bus driver or a girl's soccer coach. How we ended up inheriting Truman's sisters, Smudge, Sarah, and Portia, is a story for another time that indirectly involves Dua Lipa. Portia is a true Daria, staring blankly from her perch on the wall, hissing at anyone who passes like she's a living sculpture. Smudge, meanwhile, would be the Charlotte in any Sex and the City lineup, innocent, trusting, with a perfect chin. As if on cue, our posse of 5, 3 British short hairs and a shade I call London Dusk, a very special Maine Coon, and an orange blimp who is luckily living in a country where he doesn't immediately evoke Garfield, began to spread further afield. Even Luis had to admit that he worried sometimes, never more than the day he heard, and then spied, Portia standing atop the local church bell. He had to ask the vicar, who looked like he was being played by a very method Barry Keoghan, to take a ladder up to retrieve her, at which point she ran in coquettish circles. Then there was the night that a rainstorm came so fast and heavy that Rhett didn't make it home for dinner, his one true passion, and we lay in bed guessing where he might be. A garden shed left unlocked, a nest of leaves and twigs, his friend Edward's council flat. If I name a friend and you wonder if they're human or feline, the fact is, so do we. But if allowing the cats out gives me anxiety, it was only as much as having friends ever did. I had always felt a terror of abandonment and a curiosity about how everyone else seemed to sustain their relationships with so much less anxiety than I did. But the best thing I could do for my cats would be to treat them with the laughing acceptance, nurturing warmth, and unerring flexibility I hoped to be granted in my own life. They had all come out, as a friend once said of children, exactly as they're going to be. The real cat wives of Islington, who offer me comforts no human pal could, the way Truman appears at the head of our bed and licks our hairline gently, the dozens of autumn leaves Elegance carries through the cat door one at a time and arranges like Ikebana, the sleek, seal-like wetness of their coats when they find their way home to dry off by the clanking heater. I don't know who else they're keeping company, but I have to guess they've seen a world of interiors, been invited into more homes than I've been over the last 5 years. I'm only a little jealous. I mean, how could I not be? We're all human. The Great Cosmetic Undoing, legions who flocked to dermatologists and plastic surgeons to be filled and plumped now seek to reverse their procedures. Marissa Meltzer surveys what they're getting undone now. Photographs by Henry Lutweiler. Opening photograph shows a tray with what looks like a deflated balloon on it. Downsizing isn't just for empty nesters anymore. Med spas, dermatologists, and plastic surgeons are reporting that the pillowy, plumped-up look of the past decade is suddenly passé. But while it's relatively simple to transform platinum hair back to a natural brunette, cosmetic undoing takes a lot more work, and time, and money, and pain tolerance. Even so, patients are following in the footsteps of pioneers like Victoria Beckham, who had her breast implants removed, and Kylie Jenner and Courtney Cox, both of whom have spoken openly about having dermal filler dissolved. They may be hoping that an excavation will reveal their original bone structure, or at least lips that don't look like they're in the throes of anaphylactic shock. Muneeb Shah, D.O., a board-certified dermatologist with nearly 18 million followers on TikTok as Derm Doctor, fields these kinds of questions all the time. Filler, he says, is the most common cosmetic treatment he sees getting reversed, though simply dissolving it won't get the job done. Once you have all that volume in your skin, when you take it away, it's like a deflated balloon. You're getting more crepiness and sagging, more wrinkly, he says. He advises his deflating clients to try radiofrequency microneedling, such as Morpheus 8, to tighten their skin. We have patients who had years and years of filler, says Melissa Doft, MD, who runs the kind of low-key Park Avenue office that's a magnet for wealthy moms, clad head to toe in the row. One patient wanted her filler dissolved because she missed her natural bone structure, only to be horrified when she could see how much she'd aged. So she requested a very subtle facelift, the sort of procedure some younger women plan ahead for, to the extent that they're skipping filler so it won't interfere with their future nip and tuck. As women seek smaller lips, they're also seeking daintier breast implants, or removing the implants altogether, sometimes adding a breast lift and some fat grafting from the stomach, thighs, or flanks to create a subtly natural shape. Big breasts might have looked sexy at a certain time in your life, but you get older and it makes you look chubby and matronly, says Doft. And don't downplay the effects of mass semaglutide usage either. Using it gives devotees a hollowed-out so-called Ozempic face, and the combination of implants and rapid weight loss, Doft says, make women look like boobs on a stick. Few procedures are harder to reverse than a buttock augmentation. Trying to undo a Brazilian butt lift, or BBL, by sucking it out of the body carries the risk for nerve damage, asymmetry, and skin laxity. Last year, Anastasio Stas-Karnakoglu, a friend of Jenner's, documented the arduous process of getting hers reversed. She said on her debut podcast that her BBL is something that I regret and that I've been actively trying to fix for so long. I literally have another surgery, like in a few weeks, to try and reduce the size of it even more. The easiest way to avoid having to undo cosmetic procedures, of course, is not to get them in the first place, or at least to think very carefully before tapping the Amex to pay for lip filler. In other words, caveat injector. For the sake of argument, Charlie Kirk did it. So did Mehdi Hasan and Candace Owens. Why are the internet's loudest voices making videos for Jubilee Media? Chris Murphy looks inside a controversial internet success story. Opening photo shows a man speaking through a megaphone with his face obscured, and he has a bell in his right hand. Charlie Kirk is sitting on a white folding chair in the middle of a hot gray warehouse. Around him looms some 24 people, an eclectic, college brochure-level diverse group. "Hello, everyone," he says directly to the camera. "I'm Charlie Kirk, the founder of Turning Point USA, and I'm surrounded by 20 woke college students." And then the games begin. While boomers are busy falling asleep to Fox News and the recently rebranded MS Now, Zoomers are watching clips from Surrounded, a YouTube series where notables like Candace Owens, Ben Shapiro, and Pete Buttigieg debate pressing issues with strangers who despise everything they stand for. Episode titles are simple, clear, and perfectly search engine optimized, and apparently the formula works. Jubilee Media, which created Surrounded, has a massive following. "We're 10 million subscribers on YouTube and another 12 million on social," says Nick Crooks, the company's head of business development. "Monthly," adds founder Jason Y. Lee, "we're getting almost 400 million views across all of our platforms." Kirk starred in Jubilee's first ever Surrounded video, One Conservative versus 25 Liberal College Students, posted on September 8, 2024. The 90-minute video has more than 39 million views on YouTube to date, making it the company's most watched release by a wide margin. Lee claims it's also the most watched video Kirk ever appeared in, an assertion that's tough to verify. While Kirk was a rising star in conservative politics before his Surrounded appearance, his video and the dozens of viral clips it spawned of Kirk either owning or getting owned by a prototypical leftist named Naima, both readings are possible depending on a viewer's priors, raised his profile. Jubilee introduced Kirk to a wider audience. Kirk set the Jubilee machine in motion. Almost exactly a year after he single-handedly sparred with 25 liberals, Kirk would be killed by a gunman while engaging in a Jubilee-style debate with college students at Utah Valley University. Kirk was scheduled to appear in another Surrounded video before he was shot. Lee doesn't remember Kirk as a right-wing firebrand and intentional provocateur, let alone an arguable racist and homophobe. "I think there's almost a necessity that we actually need to engage with someone like a Charlie Kirk," he says, months after Kirk's death, and the same on the left. The founder's most sincere wish is for Jubilee to bridge the yawning chasm that bisects our woefully divided nation. "We want a table where anyone is welcome, so long as you're not throwing food at others," he says. Buttigieg, for one, felt very comfortable during his Surrounded episode, which earned more than 3 million views on YouTube. "The experience I had was very good faith, earnest, real discussion, debate," the one-time presidential candidate tells me. "I would love for there to be more of that." Mehdi Hasan, who stars in Surrounded's second most watched video ever, One Progressive versus 20 Far-Right Conservatives, has a different take. He'd seen Kirk's Surrounded. As a self-described sucker for punishment, he happily volunteered to enter the ring himself. But Hasan found that his crowd was notably more hostile than opponents had been to either Kirk or Buttigieg. "You're not an American," said one to Hasan, who is an American citizen. I don't care about being called a Nazi, said another, after Hassan called him out for quoting Nazi intellectual Carl Schmitt. Hassan sat there for nearly 3 hours, being berated by white nationalists and xenophobes as the cameras rolled. What are we doing here? He asked with dismay at one point. I don't debate fascist. I think it's fair to say it's the most insane one by a mile, Hassan tells me of his surrounded episode. I got a couple of normal people and 18 crazy people. The vast majority of them were unhinged, extreme, openly racist, self-proclaimed fascist. And close proximity to all that hatred takes a toll, even on a professional arguer like Hassan. One thing I would like to remind people, especially white people, there is a cost. There is a personal, emotional, psychological cost to spending 2.5 hours with people telling you, you're not an American, get out of our country, you'll never belong. Lee recognizes that Hassan's surrounded experience was less than ideal. You won't see those folks on our platform moving forward, he says. But he also won't let a few neo-Nazis spoil the party. Despite how I personally feel about some of those things that are being said, I think it is still a productive and important thing for us to have these hard conversations, the founder tells me. The risk of us being in echo chambers is way worse than bumping into what I would say is real racism, or real, he hesitates for a moment, choosing his words carefully. Some really, I would say, unsavory or vile points of view. For someone whose business model thrives on conflict, Lee himself comes across as sweet and docile, answering even pointed questions with a smile. Unlike many of the characters found in surrounded videos, Lee seems incapable of losing his temper or raising his voice. He's good-natured, as he explains his goal for Jubilee Media, which stops just short of world domination. We want to be the Disney for human connection, he says, evoking one of his favorite phrases. The 37-year-old will cite human connection no less than 12 times over the course of our 2 interviews. Our mission statement is to provoke understanding. It's not to make viral digital content. Jubilee's headquarters isn't exactly the Magic Kingdom. Lee's Los Angeles-based company is housed in an anonymous office complex in the shadow of LAX, across a busy boulevard from a McDonald's and a rundown Holiday Inn. It's a humble space for a man from humble beginnings, the child of Korean immigrants who felt isolated growing up as one of the few non-white people in his Kansas hometown. After graduating from Wharton, Lee worked on HIV/AIDS research in Zambia with the Clinton Health Access Initiative, had a gig at the Treasury Department, and pounded the campaign trail volunteering for a young Senator Barack Obama. Despite this resume, Lee is reluctant to talk about his own political beliefs. I try my darndest to make sure that this does not affect anything that we do, he says. He's much happier to discuss the ideological problem that plagued him during this period. We were doing a lot of good, but in a lot of ways, I felt like we were preaching to the choir, he says. Lee would know. He's an observant Christian. He's also happy to relay Jubilee's origin story, a tale Lee delivers with the well-practiced air of someone pitching investors. While working as a consultant at Bain in 2010, Lee filmed an earnest, cringy video of himself busking at the Union Square subway stop to raise money for earthquake relief in Haiti, then posted it on YouTube. After raising about $10,000, he decided to go all in on digital media. His initial venture was called the Jubilee Project. The name contains Lee's first initial and surname, but it was also inspired by an Old Testament term for a ritual that would set free wrongfully imprisoned people. There's also a nerdier rationale. I don't know if you're an X-Men fan, but the one Asian American X-Men is Jubilee, the girl with a yellow trench coat. Jubilee began as a 501c3 and would remain a nonprofit for about 7 years, partnering with other nonprofits to make treacly short films about tricky subjects like autism. One video, Fireflies, was inspired by and mimics Taylor Swift's You Belong With Me video and sex trafficking. In 2017, after Donald Trump's first election, Lee transitioned the Jubilee Project into the for-profit media company now known as Jubilee Media. In theory, he wanted to use the company as a means to heal a country at odds with itself. In practice, it's followed a well-worn path from Obama-era Hope Corps to Trump-era Conflict Corps. There's this inability for us to have dialogue, empathy, even have real conversations about things that we disagree on, Lee says, with the dorky conviction of a youth pastor on Sunday morning. In 2022, Jubilee Media raised $1 million in capital, bringing its funding total to $3.25 million. And signed with talent agency WME, though hard numbers aren't publicly available, and Lee and Crooks won't give me any specifics, some estimates say that the media company pulls in anywhere from $100 million to $250 million annually. Lee says that Jubilee is profitable, and that most of the money comes from programmatic revenue. YouTube ads, basically. But Crooks and company are looking to flip that model on its head in the near future. We need to do a better job of getting to the market and showing that we can drive growth through direct revenue as opposed to programmatic, says Crooks. On Jubilee's website, you can find all 37 employees smiling in childhood portraits, a cutesy touch that also obscures their adult identities. In a fit of anachronistic enthusiasm for multiculturalism, Lee stresses that the Jubilee team is as intentionally diverse as the cast of their videos, racially, ethnically, politically, ideologically, and their numbers are growing. Jubilee's revenue has doubled in the past year, says Crooks. Next year, we look to double again. In the photos, debate team, Jason Y. Lee, founder of Jubilee Media, oversees the making of a Surrounded video, and Pete Buttigieg in Jubilee's One Politician Versus 25 Undecided Voters episode. Before his death, Kirk expressed a single frustration with his Surrounded video. Jubilee had allegedly told Kirk that his opponents would be amateurs. In reality, Kirk claimed on the George Jenko show half of them were college kids, half of them were professional TikTok debaters. Lee contradicts this characterization. He insists the highly vetted participants on Surrounded are all regular, non-famous individuals, chosen by Jubilee's four-person casting team and paid a very small amount, the SAG day rate, Lee believes, to shoot the videos. Casting, Lee maintains, is the secret sauce that makes Jubilee videos stand out in a crowded media field. We are able to bring together prominent or really incredible laypeople who will demonstrate and share their anecdotes, their stories, their experiences really honestly and vulnerably. While reporting this story, I surreptitiously applied to appear in a Jubilee video featuring single men. I was not selected. Perhaps relatedly, I'm not single. The application asks detailed questions about race, sexual orientation, gender identity, and religious preference, providing a bevy of possibilities for each category. Further down, you could type in your political affiliation, social media handles, and submit two photos. Below all that, there was a deceptively simple query that reached beyond identity. Would anything of concern be found if we performed a background check on you? You could respond yes or no. An apparent neo-Nazi who says he participated in Hassan's episode must have checked no. After the video premiered, a Florida native who goes by Chaotic Hermes online posted a photo of himself sitting in one of the show's signature white folding chairs with the caption, "I didn't go up during Jubilee because Hassan smelled like shit." And in this sentence, he misspells Hassan. His social media presence reveals Chaotic Hermes as an unabashed Nazi sympathizer. He's posted hundreds of white nationalist and racist memes on the platforms that haven't banned him. In a since-deleted Reddit post, Jubilee viewers wondered whether Chaotic Hermes was telling the truth about appearing in Hassan's video, and if he was so overtly racist that he was ultimately cut out of the episode. In an interview on The Bulwark, Hassan addressed the controversy and Chaotic Hermes' claim, "I can't reveal what happened in terms of the taping and editing, but that's fundamentally untrue," said Hassan. Chaotic Hermes did not respond to a request for comment. Hassan didn't respond to a follow-up question about Chaotic Hermes. A source close to Jubilee confirms that Chaotic Hermes did appear in Hassan's episode, but was edited out of it. According to the source, Jubilee was not aware of Chaotic Hermes' hundreds of white nationalist posts. The source says Chaotic Hermes would not have been cast if it had been. Lee maintains that Jubilee's casting process has been evolving since its inception, and that everyone's safety on set is the company's first priority. He says that Jubilee has security screenings before cameras begin to roll, and that not everyone sails through them. The company has had to ask people who weren't being cooperative to leave the set. "We are trying to improve the way that we do content so that it is a place for good faith debate and productive conversation," Lee says, when asked about Hassan's episode. He then backpedals to his favorite topic, human connection, which is not a perfect process, he says. "The question that I would go back to is, what is the perspective that we would try to push or frame?" Lee sounds uncharacteristically frustrated, but he's still smiling. "Why would we hire actors?" he says, after I ask him about a persistent internet rumor claiming the debaters in Jubilee aren't authentic. "There is not one reason. That's why it's hard for me to fathom that question." Three of the surroundees I spoke to, all of whom Jubilee offered to connect me with, had no issue with any of the people Jubilee chose for their debate. But left-wing commentator Sam Cedar, whom I reached independently, felt differently. He told me that he was surprised to find out that some of the people he debated in a video called "One Progressive Versus 20 Trump Supporters" were unabashed Christian nationalists, and claimed that the final edit of his episode had left out some of their most outrageous behavior. "Some were fascistic and white supremacist out and out, unashamed," says Cedar. "There was one that they cut out that was even more over the top than what you saw." The issue with Jubilee, some participants argue, isn't that it might hire a wannabe actor from time to time, or that it platforms controversial public figures. It's that Jubilee also gives people like Chaotic Hermes a seat at the table, and tacitly, a permission structure to spread their extremist views. Allowing white supremacists to spew their hate, then editing them out of the final product, is a very 2026 way of trying to have it both ways. "I think it's important to say, we don't think that we're a perfect company," Lee tells me. "We are inherently doing something that's very, very human. That involves a lot of humans. And I think part of the experience is growth and learning and changing." Good faith or bad, Jubilee's reach is undeniable. It was very striking, not just the number of people who saw it, but the people who saw it were often people who didn't see the other things I did, says Buttigieg. "This is during a month when I might have done a dozen or more major TV appearances. Some young people would come up to me and say, 'I saw you on this thing,' in a way that made it clear to me that they hadn't seen any of those others." But even now, the former transportation secretary says, elected officials and strategists give him a blank look when he asks if they've heard of Jubilee. They say no, and I say, "Well, I didn't either. And it turns out it's got way more viewership than a lot of TV shows that you do know." As one may expect, Jubilee primarily reaches young people. Gen Xers who participate in Surrounded often say that they had no idea what Jubilee was before they agreed to make content for it. I got this request to do it, says Cedar. My daughter was home for Christmas break. She's a college student. And I'm like, have you ever heard of this Jubilee thing? And she's like, you have to do it. I think young people are so interested and invested in Jubilee because a lot of what they see around them is not that, says Lee. Everything from politics to even shows and other things, it's so scripted or it's so controlled. And I think that that's something that we're really excited about. Jubilee also practices what it preaches. Lee estimates that the team is primarily composed of Zoomers, while crooks say the average age for employees is 24 years old. Detractors accuse Jubilee of memifying political discourse by posting transparent rage bait, content designed not to build bridges, but rather to feed an insatiable algorithm that thrives on conflict. Surrounded videos, they say, are created with the intention of inflaming emotions and sowing division, all for clicks and cash. Lee doesn't see it that way. Certainly the algorithm has a part to play, he says, but we think that the problem and the root is far deeper, and part of it is the lost ability to have discourse. We've lost the ability or the courage to sit in discomfort even. But if we think about the human experience, we have to bump into each other. Lee means that literally. He thinks the company's future is in live events, like a recent in-person dating experience at UCLA that drew almost 1,000 students. He expects Jubilee to produce its first live Surrounded, complete with studio audience, in the next 12 to 18 months. I suspect that by end of spring, we'll do an entire college tour, Lee says. Kirk lost his life on just such a tour. But Lee doesn't seem overly concerned about the potential safety issues. We want to create content, experiences, even technology that brings people together, he says. In moments like this, he sounds a lot like Mark Zuckerberg, another founder with purportedly earnest aims. We all know how that's turned out. Cedar, too, is skeptical, not of the live event strategy, but Lee's theory of human connection. I think this country is polarized, and I don't think people will be brought together by YouTube, he says. And while his own experience was positive-ish, he's not sure whether he'd recommend another commentator work with Jubilee in the wake of Hassan's episode. The casting is a real problem, he says. Making another video with Lee's company is not impossible for me to imagine, but I would need assurances about the vetting. Potentially, I would be up for doing it again, says Buttigieg. For all of the thousands of interviews that I've done, this was a pretty formative one in terms of my understanding of the new media landscape, and one that has stuck with me as one of the most important and interesting that I did in that entire political cycle. Perhaps he should be careful what he wishes for. Lee tells me Jubilee already has eyes on the 2028 election and hopes that his company will moderate an actual, real-deal debate among White House hopefuls. I think there's a reason why young people are no longer tuning in to these presidential debates, he says. People value politicians who can engage and speak clearly, directly to their audiences. And I think that that's why Jubilee is really well poised and the perfect partner. That's hilarious, Hassan says when I tell him this. But he knows too much to laugh too loud or for too long. I mean, look, we live in America, he says. It could happen. I wouldn't be surprised. we nominate for Oblivion, Mercury in Retrograde. What does it actually mean? And why is everybody so weird about it? Hilary Busis considers this celestial nonsense. Illustration by Ben Giles, which shows a human hand attempting to thump the universe into oblivion with the planets all lined up behind the moon. It's a positioning thing, I take it. The planets glide, silently performing their extraterrestrial ballet until one goes behind Mercury. Mercury goes behind it. I want to say the sun's involved. Frankly, Mercury in retrograde is none of my business, and I can't be bothered to research it any further. Read at all. I do not have the bandwidth to add this concept to my mental load because I'm an adult, with the children, mortgage, and localized plantar fasciitis to prove it. I suggest you join me, not in crushing debt, but in rejecting American culture's pervasive backward slide into pre-modern flimflam. Surely you, a reasonable, presumably literate, fully grown person, or perhaps a pretentious teenager, can agree that earnestly believing in astrology is silly at best. Surely you would not sincerely credit your good luck, let alone your misfortunes, to the movement of an inanimate hunk of rock. Wouldn't show up late, or cancel plans, or find yourself in a foul mood because Mercury's in retrograde, whatever that even means. Surely you can't be serious. Look, on some level, I get it. Mystic trust in the power of Mercury, or whatever spans generations and intellectual capacities. The most astrology-obsessed people I've ever met were grad students. Attempting to rationalize our chaotic existence is among the oldest human impulses. It must be comforting to chalk up undenied, undesired outcomes to forces beyond anyone's individual control, to abdicate authority and submit to the strong hand of fate. I believe this is what Baby Girl was about. Only a nerd takes pleasure in responsibility, and we are firmly ensconced in an anti-nerd epoch. That said, what's more sufferable, a skeptical know-it-all or a proud know-nothing? Fine, new question. What's more damaging? Go ahead. Take it at face value that Mercury in retrograde has some measurable effect on your day-to-day. It might feel harmless. It might feel pleasantly analog, like reading a paper book. But I know that if you do, you're just a hop, skip, and a jump away from embracing all manner of woo-woo-hooey. Reiki, sound bathing, the telepathy tapes, tarot, Santa Claus, phrenology. You may as well be a TikToker, convinced you can cure flu symptoms by putting potatoes in your socks. You may as well be Kim Kardashian, furious that she didn't pass the California bar exam, even though her psychics told her she would. Psychics, plural. Every waking hour, the internet bombards us with slop and made-up garbage. I refuse to live in a techno-dystopia where a critical mass also thinks astrology is real. Pick a lane, people. If you absolutely must infuse your life with ancient baloney, why not try more interesting forms of paganism instead? Norse mythology, Cambodian folklore. Or look further into the cosmos. Could the dwarf planet Haumea be blamed for your flight getting canceled? There's a galaxy out there called Hoag's Object. Is that anything? There are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in a grad student's philosophy. If we've collectively agreed to pretend bogus BS is real, and I fear we have, we may as well get creative with it. But the Saturn return? Don't even get me started. This program is intended for the blind and print impaired community. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Or you can tell your smart speaker to play North Carolina Reading Service. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.